welcome to Comic Talk Today for Thursday, July 19th, 2018. And yes, it is Thursday, which means it is time for a little Therapy Thursday. And of course, every week on Therapy Thursday, I bring a guest on. And this week, my guest is writer extraordinaire Cullen Bunn. Of course, you may know him from titles such as X-Men Blue, Harrow County, Shadow Rhodes, Deadpool Assassin. God, the man's done so many books. He was a fantastic guest. Normally, I chat a little bit with my guests before I start recording. And this time, we started chatting, and Cullen brought up some of the tools that he uses to outline his work, to get his scripts together. And I was like, this is gold. I gotta start here. So I just hit record. So once the interview starts, you'll see that maybe you're gonna be missing about a minute or two of the conversation. You did not miss a whole much, but we kick off talking about Scrivener, which is one of the pieces of software that he uses to keep his stuff together, and then the conversation goes on from there. We talked about his writing process, how he manages his time, all the books that he has done, his love of horror, my love of horror. It was a joy to talk to Cullen. It was a true pleasure to go into the mind of a writer who does so many, so many books. So check the interview out. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll catch you tomorrow.
Fred Van Lente suggested that I try Scrivener, and I've been using it for a while now. I don't think I've learned all the tricks of Scrivener yet.
Yeah.
But I definitely, I definitely like the way it works.
Interesting. I might check that out because, I've looked at – Fred's got a bunch of scripts and stuff on his website.
According to him, all of his were written through Scrivener.
Really?
So, and I haven't looked at the scripts on his website, but like I said, last I talked to him, he said everything he does is through Scrivener now. So
interesting. I might have to check that out. That's cool.
Yeah. It's a cool software.
Is that your main tool, or is there other stuff that you use as well to create your stuff?
Now that's become my main, my main writing tool. I use Scrivener, and I use, strangely enough, notes on my iPad. But that's only because I tend to do a lot of writing, and I tend to do a lot of writing like early in the morning when I first wake up and I don't want to get out of bed. So I just grab the iPad and I'll write there in bed, and I use notes for a lot of that. Although Scrivener has an app too, so I guess I could write directly on my iPad for that as well.
I'm assuming you have to use a keyboard though, right, on the iPad?
Yeah, I use a keyboard. I can't type on screen.
Yeah, I was gonna say that doesn't seem like it would work very well. Wouldn't be very efficient.
No,
that's cool. I like getting those tips from guys. I know most people don't seem to care, but I'm really more interested in their process, especially somebody like you that, okay, you don't do 10 books, but you do, I mean, you're doing like 6 or 7 at least.
Yeah, that's probably, it's at least 6 or 7. Yeah. And it may be 10. The thing is, I don't see it that way because I'm not working on those. In some cases, I'm so far ahead, I don't have to work on 10 books each month. I may only be working on, 6 this month, and then it rotates out. There's another, there are different books that I'm working on each month.
So how do you divide your time for that? Do you say to yourself, like, okay, I'm going to work today on Bone Parish, and then tomorrow I'll do X-Men? Or is it just whatever mood you're in, whatever the deadlines are, maybe?
Yeah, it's all based on deadlines, first of all. And speaking of other tools I use Todoist to manage my deadlines, which is just a deadline tracking tool on a to-do list tool online. But I use that to track all my deadlines, and I just kind of keep an eye on that. So when I open my computer, when I sit down on my computer first thing, I see like a 7-day guide of what is due, what's coming up, what's coming up in the next few days. And I just have to decide which project I need to work on, first to make sure I'm meeting those deadlines. And sometimes that means, I might be writing Bone Parish for 2 days in a row, to finish a script up, or 3 days in a row. Sometimes it means I have to, work on that a couple of days and then maybe switch gears, on day 3 to work on something else for a little while. Mm-hmm. But it's all about deadlines. I live in sort of a constant fear of the artists I'm working with not having something to do. So I want to make sure that the artists are always fed. They always have work that they, that they can do. They're never sitting twiddling their thumbs.
Sure.
That's kind of important to me. And I just have to kind of judge the deadlines that are coming up and make a judgment call of what I need to work on first. And sometimes that means, you know, I look at a project list and I think to myself, you know, this issue of Bone Parish is much more solidified in my mind than, say, this issue of, I don't know, you know, As Guardians of the Galaxy.
Sure.
So I may, you know, I may need to spend more time with As Guardians of the Galaxy than I do Bone Parish. And that will you know, inform my decisions.
How far ahead do you try to stay on the scripts?
That's a wonderful question. Used to be, like, years ago, I was months and months ahead of the artists that I worked with. That is no longer the case. You know, there are times, you know, much to my chagrin, that, you know, I get emails saying, hey, just so you know, the artist on this book is going to be done on Friday. Can we get a script by Friday? And I have to make sure that I get those pages to him. So in some cases, I'm only just ahead of the artist. You know, in a perfect world, I'm several months, you know, I'm a few months ahead, or at least a month ahead, but that is not always the case anymore. You know, and that really comes to light when you're dealing, you know, when you're working with on a project where, the artists change.
Yeah.
I mean, I write X-Men Blue, and I've been writing that for a number of issues now. And there were plenty of times where because of the artist change, I'm writing issues, say, and this isn't exactly, this is just as an example, but this happens many times, issue 22 and issue 26 at the same time, because two different artists have to have books, you know, have to have work to do.
Right.
So I may be writing part one of arc 4 and part one of arc 5 at the same time.
See, that goes into a different section then, because how do you manage to fit that into your head?
Right? You don't. I don't think anyone ever really wraps their brain around it. I try to plan pretty far ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But even though, you know, those plans, especially with a book that's not a creator-owned book, but I mean, even with a creator-owned book, those plans often, you know, are shifting and they change, and things change as you're working on as you're writing a script. You realize things in your outlines don't necessarily work when you get to the page. And you just have to be adaptable, and sometimes absolutely that causes headaches, and you can write yourself into a corner, because, you know, once, you know, if you, let's say I'm working on, you know, part one of arc 3 and part one of arc 4, whatever I write in arc 4 has to be backed up in arc 3. So, so I can't, you know, once it's written in arc 4, it can't be changed and you're moving towards it. So if while writing arc 3, I realize, oh my gosh, that doesn't work, I've got to figure out a way to make it work, which can be, you know, which presents a whole new, you know, all sorts of frustrations and headaches. But, it's also, you know, those things exercise the creative muscles in different ways. So, you know, after the fact, I can easily say, hey, that was a fun exercise, a fun challenge. But while it's going on, I may be, you know, sitting here banging my head against the desk.
Yeah, I gotcha. You know, I've tried to do outlines for, you know, I play around with writing stories all the time. Obviously, I'm never gonna actually pursue any of them, I don't think. It's just more of a mental exercise for me. But, you know, I hear a lot about writers doing the outline thing, and I've tried to do outlines, and even going all the way back to school, where, like, it was mandatory that you present an outline before you do your final paper or whatever, I always had such a tough time, like, putting those thoughts into, like, a step-by-step. You know, I always felt like it was easier for me to just write and start writing and just let it go, right? Like, let the process work for itself.
Yeah. You know, that there's a, I had never heard this term until recently. There's like school of thoughts. And what you're describing is the I think it's called the pantser, which means you're going by the, you're writing by the seat of your pants. And that's how I was too for a very long time. And especially with prose, I absolutely am a pants, or have been a pantser in the past. But, when I started working in comics, I realized you just can't do it.
Yeah.
Because you are, or at least I can't, because you're so constrained in comics. When, you know, when you're writing a short story or a novel or an article, you may have word limits, but for the most part, you're free to go. You know, you can follow tangents and do whatever you want. But with a comic, you are absolute, you know, there's an absolute there. You're limited by the number of issues in an arc or the number of issues in a series. You're limited by the number of pages in an issue, and you're limited by the number of panels on a page. So the only way for me to organize that and keep it flowing and keep the pacing right, and I don't always get it right, but to keep the pacing where it needs to be is through these outlines.
Yeah.
So I have, you know, especially with comics, I do a ton of outlining. And now I'm getting back into prose a little bit more, and I find myself, I don't like that I don't have outlines for, you know, I don't like that anymore. So I want to make sure I have outlines for my prose stuff as well. And there's a great book. I can't think of the author's name now, that goes back to the idea of pantsers versus, you know, whatever the other, the other school of thought is. There's a great book that I bought and I've read, and I'm going to reread it. Called Take Off Your Pants. Take Off Your Pants. Outline Your Books for Faster, Better Writing. And it's by Libby Hawker. I just looked it up just to make sure I had the title right. But yeah, and it's all about, you know, how to outline for prose. And I've kind of been, you know, digging into that a little bit lately as well.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. I see it here on Amazon. I might check that out. I don't know. I've just been, my big thing was always like postmodern lit. That was my major in college. Mm-hmm. And the way that I read those stories that were really fascinating to me was, the reason I liked them is because they read kind of like I thought, you know?
Sure.
And so I always assumed like if that's the way that I'm thinking and that's the way that I'm reading my favorite works, then maybe that's also the way that I should write.
Sure.
But yeah, no, this makes total sense.
And, you know, one of my favorite authors, Joe Lansdale, I remember an interview with him, and he said that he doesn't do outlines because he wants to be surprised by his own story.
And that
stuck with me, and I still think about it. I don't know if he still writes without a very detailed outline or not, but I remember him saying that, you know, from years and years back.
Hmm. Do you find some of those constraints are different when you're doing your creator-owned stuff over your stuff at Marvel, let's say?
Yeah, I mean, there are different philosophies even, you know, and different editors. Like some editors, have said, you know, they don't want more than five panels on a page, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. And I think back to the Six Gun, the book I did with Brian Hurt.
Yep.
Where I think our average panel count was six or seven on the page. And I feel like we pulled everything off pretty nicely in that. And so, you know, I'll take more risks with that kind of thing, with the pacing and the panel counts and stuff like that with creator-owned books sometimes. Sometimes I work it into my, you know, my Marvel stuff. Lately, I've been doing more of my own thing with some of the Marvel stuff, to mixed degrees of reception among editorial. I don't know. So yeah, maybe a little bit, you know, the constraints are a little different. But you know, even with creator owned stuff, you know, sometimes you plan for a 10 issue series and you end up only getting five, and you have to adjust for that kind of thing as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they have, they definitely have guidelines, right, on the kind of stuff that they want. But I think, you know, some of the stuff that's really successful is when they try new ways to format books or new ways of telling stories. I was talking to a friend of mine last night about Marvel, in fact, because it seems like Marvel's received a lot of new talent within the last couple of years, right? Like Donny Cates came out there, and Rosenberg, and a bunch of those guys, Zach Thompson, and they're bringing a lot more what feels like an indie book to these Marvel characters, right?
Well, I think they've always, you know, I feel like that's always been, at least in my experience since I started there, you know, that's really where they harvest most of their talent is from the indie side of things. You know, they see what these creators do with their indie book, and then they approach them and ask them to write you know, something for Marvel, yeah, and or DC or IDW or whoever, and a great editor who will choose a writer like that will recognize that they chose that writer for a reason. They tapped that writer to work on this book because they like their work on their indie book, and a great editor will let them do their thing. And it all depends on, you know, the editorial talent too, and the editor's willingness to let a writer do what they do.
Mm-hmm. How much input do editors at Marvel say have over the direction of the book that you're doing? I mean, I would assume a little bit more, right? In particular now with the movies being so successful, I'm sure there's definitely a much tighter direction over there.
You know, it's not too bad. I mean, they obviously, these characters are part of a bigger world and a bigger, you know, besides being part of a bigger world, they're part of a bigger corporation. And there are things they do and don't want you to do, with these characters. So there's, you know, there are definitely guidelines that you wouldn't get on a creator-owned book because the characters are yours and, you know, do what you want to with them. But yeah, there are things they won't let you do or are going to try to head you away from doing, and there might be other plans for those characters. You know, they might be appearing in an event that's coming up or in someone else's book, and you have to play, you know, you have to play nice with what's going on elsewhere in the company.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there may be guidelines that certain things these characters wouldn't do or shouldn't do. But for the most part, you know, within the story itself, you're pretty free to do, you know, to do your own thing, you know, outside of those guidelines.
Yeah, no, I get it. And I mean, I think that they've definitely done a better job at not doing the event thing all the dang time. You know, when I was growing up, it was like event after event, especially in the X books, right? It's like every single issue tied into every single other current book. And it was hard to follow. You know, especially being like 12 years old and you have to buy like 5 books so you get the whole story instead of one. Like, there's only so many like lawns you can mow. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But, yeah, no, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah. And, you know, and the thing is with those events, I mean, they sell. That's the, you know, even
well,
now,
sure,
you know,
yeah,
doing an event, they sell. You know, I remember, you know, I've told the story many times, but I remember years and years ago, I was signing at a comic book store and, I can't remember what event was going on at the time, but there was an event going on in DC and an event going on at Marvel at the same time. And it was one of those events that had tons of crossover issues. And this customer came in and he just started ranting almost as soon as he came in about how much he hates events and how all he wants is a good story. Stop writing events. Stop it. You know, stop the events. And I said, hey man, you know, come over here and look at the Six Gun. Here's a book that ties into nothing else. You know, you can read this book and enjoy it all for yourself. And he looked at it and then he put it back down and then he went and grabbed his books off the shelf. And he had to buy 20 books that day. If he, maybe more than that, 20 or 30 books that he walked by, after he, you know, was done browsing the shelves. And I said, hey, you mind if I take a look? Let me see what you got this week. And every book in his stack was an event comic. Every book was an event or an event tie-in. And he went up and he paid his money and he ranted the entire way about how much he hates events.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all he bought.
Yeah, he's probably in that mindset. I think a lot of people are in that same mindset though, right? Like, regardless of whatever else great is coming out, like if you follow, like, I'm a big Batman fan, for example. Regardless of whatever happens with Batman, I buy Batman. Like, right now, I don't enjoy Batman very much, but I'm still buying it. And I think a lot of people have that mentality.
Yeah, I get it. That's a collector mentality, and that's awesome, I suppose. But, and everybody should read comics for whatever purpose and buy comics for whatever purpose or reason that they want to. You know, mm-hmm. They can follow every word and take it all as gospel. They could read one title and assume that's the only continuity they're going to follow. I applaud every reason and everybody's, you know, purpose in reading comics however they like or for whatever reason they like, or collecting, even if they don't read any comics, they just buy them all and put them in bags and boards and put them in a box. That's fine too. I don't care. Do it, you know, you do you.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's tough though, you know, from a corporate standpoint, you know, these companies, you know, they have to make money.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, and that's a tough challenge. I think, And I don't know if anybody's getting it right or has gotten it right or have gotten it in a right that's gotten it right in a way that's sustainable. But, you know, I'm glad I don't have to make those decisions about what's going to be a profitable, you know, business model for the long term for comic books, because I think it's I think it's probably always been difficult. And I think it's probably more difficult now than it's been in a long while.
Yeah, I was thinking about that right before we started recording, because apparently Gail Simone is taking over at Catalyst Prime, that side of the Line Forge universe. And I thought that was so interesting that first you would get approached. Would you be interested in ever doing something like that? Like,
well, being strangely the architect? Funny enough, years ago, I was actually the guy writing Catalyst Prime.
Really?
But the books never came out, and that's because Lion Forge, they were publishing originally for digital only, and the formatting was honestly, I thought the formatting was strange. It was like half page. You know, it was formatted for digital.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we wrote, and those books never came out. But there's a whole Catalyst Prime, you know, arc out there that I wrote. I don't think it was ever – I think the first couple of issues of it were drawn, but they have never been published. And since then, I think Lion Forge wisely, you know, they adjusted their publishing model and they went back to formula on what they wanted to do with these books.
Mm-hmm.
And that's awesome. And actually, I think what's coming out now is better than what I was doing for them. And, I think it was a smart move on their part to kind of take a step back and refocus. And since that time, cause this was early days of Lion Forge. And, I think they have made much more of a name for themselves and have done a much better job. But yeah, you know, at one time, yeah, I absolutely was interested in it. And yeah, probably, you know, depending on the property and the world, absolutely. You know, I'd absolutely be down for something like that.
Hmm. So I got to ask you, to me, you're the horror guy. I love your horror stuff. Like, I know you talked to Ronnie a couple weeks ago on the Marvel podcast he does, and he and I have a deep fascination with Death Follows, which is really odd, I know. And of course, Harrow County. Why are you the horror guy? Cause I mean, if I look at the list of books that you've done, it almost seems like you've done a lot more superhero stuff than horror stuff.
Well, you know, and I probably said this to Rodney as well. You know, I have no idea why Marvel and DC has never tapped me to do a horror book. You know, and I've pitched horror stories to them over and over again. A lot of my most successful work at Marvel and DC is a superhero, is a horror story disguised as a superhero story. Mm-hmm. If you look at say Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe, you know, some people say it's a superhero book. Some people say it's a humor book. It's a horror story. Sure. I mean, absolutely. It is a horror story. Magneto, you know, it's an X-Men book. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I pitched that story as a horror story starring Magneto. And that's, you know, but, you know, I've never been able to sell any editorial at Marvel or DC on, you know, on the idea of let me do a horror book. You know, let me do a horror book and see what we can do with it. And part of that is, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, horror books are tough sells.
Yeah.
It, you know, an indie horror book can do well. You know, a horror book from Marvel and DC to their audiences, you kind of have to trick them into reading it. if you want it to sell, I think. And yeah, so, you know, look, my book Sinestro for DC had heavy, heavy horror elements mm-hmm. to it, but it was a space, you know, it was also a space superhero story,
right?
Or super villain story. So I may just be stuck on, you know, having to trick readers into trying them.
Well, or you may just need to wait another 10 years, right? Cause I mean, Marvel was doing stuff in the 70s, right? They were doing horror books.
Oh yeah. And horror books have a long history with comics and I think readers are open to them, but, you gotta make sure, you know, I have thoughts on what would make, a Marvel or a DC, you know, superhero comic that is also a absolute 100% horror comic. I have lots of thoughts on how to make that work. We'll see. It's at some point, some editor will bite on one of these ideas and take a chance on something like that.
Well, you know what's interesting? So Al Ewing's doing the Immortal Hulk book, and to me, that's a horror book.
Yeah, it is. And you think back, you know, I think back to my favorite run on the Hulk, which was the Bruce Jones run, from 10 years ago or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that was 1000% a horror story.
Right. Maybe they're just trying it out. You know, like, yeah. The two things that I really love are, one, horror books, which, of course, Marvel and DC don't really want to do. They kind of dabble, but they don't really want to do. And then the other one's anthology books, which nobody wants to do. That's why I love Aftershock, because they did, you know, the Shock anthology. Mm-hmm. And I think Alterna is doing a quarterly anthology comic now as well. I love those kind of things, but they don't sell well here.
Yeah, they're not as it's way back in the 70s, those books were bread and butter. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I love them as well. I've always, always loved anthology books, especially horror anthology books. But they're just such tough sells.
Yeah.
In recent years, like, it's hard to pick one that was super successful for a big publisher. I think Flinch for DC Vertigo was pretty awesome, but it only lasted, I don't know what, 18 issues or so.
Sure.
Even though it was great.
Hmm. Was there something, I know there's a story with your dad, but was there something, like, with you growing up that kind of drew you to the horror genre?
I don't know. I used to read horror comics, but I remember vividly, I was a superhero kid, but I remember there were moments where I'd take stacks of, I guess I'd just get in a mood, and I'd take stacks of DC's House of Mystery or Ghosts or the old Charlton anthology horror comics, and I'd take a stack of them, and I'd just read those, and that's what I'd read for the day. Hmm. But I was not a horror guy. I was much more superheroes. I didn't read horror novels. I watched horror movies as a kid, and I was fascinated with ghosts and vampires and werewolves, and I was fascinated with all that. But I wouldn't have said I was a diehard horror fan. But later, in high school and everything, I really got into this idea. What really kind of tipped it into horror for me, I got into this idea that I wanted to become a special effects makeup artist.
Nice.
Doing traditional makeup effects. And I wanted to do those for, obviously, for movies, and horror movies is where it's at with that, right?
Yeah.
So I really got into horror movies in a big way, and that turned into wanting to read horror stories, and that kind of turned into me wanting to tell my own horror stories. And it's, even as I'm telling you that, I think back and I'm like, man, I say I'm not a horror fan, but I remember as a kid, really, even pre-high school, reading H.P. Lovecraft and things like that, and really loving those stories. But really getting into writing horror stuff came about much, later after, around the time I wanted to be a special effects makeup artist.
Yeah, I find horror so fascinating because I think it's the genre that's the most about how weird people are, right? Like the types of things that we think about. Some of my earliest memories are, I got into horror pretty early. My dad, every time I tell the story, people that listen to this podcast are like, your dad must be an insane person, but he's the nicest person, I promise. Like, we used to watch like Friday the 13th on like Friday nights, or like all the slasher films in the 80s. Whenever there was like a Twilight Zone marathon or Outer Limits, like, we would just sit there and watch them hours at a time. And there was just something so fascinating about this world that's very much like our world, right? I love sci-fi also for the same reason, where it's very much like our world, but you're extrapolating on a lot of things and seeing things in a different perspective. And I think to me, that's what makes like horror and sci-fi so fascinating, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Mostly about people. Like, I love zombie stuff. I know people are kind of worn out with the zombie thing, but I love zombies for the same reason. Like, it's not so much about the zombie, and there's plenty of terrible zombie movies, which I still love, but, it's about how people interact when faced with these weird challenges. And maybe that's kind of what drew me to comics too. You know, because the really good superhero comics, I think, kind of say the same kind of things.
Well, sure, yeah. You know, a great story can go a outside the genre, you know, and still, you know, tell, you know, a story about characters. And that's, you know, to me, I think I can get stronger emotional reactions, I feel like, when I'm writing horror stuff. But, you know, there are plenty of writers who get great reactions in sci-fi and, you know, in every genre. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, and I think it's just all, it's dependent on the readers, you know, inclinations and the writer's inclinations.
Sure. So I want to ask you about a couple of books you do for Aftershock. So you did Unholy Grail and you're doing Dark Ark now. How did you come about the idea of doing this? I keep wanting to call it like alt history, but it's not really quite alt history. And Brothers Dracul, of course. It's not quite alt history, but it's like how would you describe it?
I've been calling it historical horror.
Okay, fair enough.
And it was not intentional. It's just these are stories that I thought would be fun to tell. You know, each of these were just things that I just pitched along with other stories that I pitched just because I like those kind of stories. And but it wasn't an intentional thing. And in fact, it never even dawned. It didn't dawn on me initially. Lisa at Aftershock asked me a question. She said, do these stories take place in the same world? and I liked that question. And no, my intent was never that they took place in the same world. But at the same time, I never say they don't, you know, and there's nothing in any of these stories that kind of blatantly contradicts the, you know, the quote unquote science in another story. Mm-hmm. So maybe they do take place in the same world, but, like I said, it wasn't intentional. It just sort of happened. You know, I'm working on some stuff for Aftershock right now that is not historical horror. It doesn't fit into the same subgenre, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm certain I will return to it at some point. It's not, you know, I can't say, you know, I remember someone saying that I was a deconstructionist, and I just like this deconstructing, you know, legends and history and turning it into something else. And that's not the case either. I just like telling stories that I think would be fun to read. Mm-hmm. So that's why that's where they all come from.
Yeah, I think they work too. I think I'm definitely digging Dark Ark the most right now. But I think you're going to some really interesting places in Brothers Dracul. I've always loved the mythology behind Vlad, and I like seeing how much Radu you have in there. Because,
yeah,
you know, like you read about the story and like Radu is kind of there, like in and out. But everybody always just portrays Vlad as like the thing. And, I just find it so interesting the way that you're handling that whole thing. I know Ronnie and I do an Aftershock podcast, so we dive pretty deep into some of these books sometimes. And, you know, like I've had this weird history with religion, and I think that's what really like chimes with me when I read Dark Ark, because, you know, Noah is there, but he's not quite the big part of the story right now.
Right.
And when you introduce like these new characters and bring in like the Greek mythology, you know, like there was the Titans reference and all that stuff. It was just so fascinating to read, right? Because a lot of people enough people take those kind of chances in even in indie books, in creator owned books.
Yeah. Dark Ark's a weird book and it's you know, look, I like all the Aftershock stuff for various reasons, but Dark Ark's my favorite right now. And part of it is it's a longer story than Unholy Grail. You know, there's more story to tell with Unholy Grail if I wanted to, but for right now, Dark Ark's the book that is the longest of my Aftershock stuff. And therefore I can delve into things a little bit deeper and go into different places. And, you know, we're working on the third arc third arc of Dark Ark. And I think, you know, it's interesting because every arc goes into a, you know, really takes the story in a vastly different direction.
Yeah.
And I'm excited for the next arc of it. I think it's going to be, I think that's going to surprise readers. And yeah, it's a book that, When I first pitched it, I never expected Aftershock to bite on it, to be honest. I didn't think they would go for it, because it's kind of an absurd, silly idea. But then when they did, I said, well, okay, now I have to take it seriously and let's take this absurd idea and really play it straight. And yeah, I've taken that and because of that, because of its origin, I think in my head of being this sort of, you know, weird, silly idea, I'm able to take some different chances with it and go in some strange places. And it's sort of there are no rules, you know, in that story or things I can't, you know, that I have to stay away from or anything. I can just go where I want to with it.
Yeah, I love Aftershock. Joe is one of my favorite people. Every time I see him at a con, we always chat a little bit. He's fantastic. And I mean, I've been following Joe for, I don't even know, how long is that now? 25 years, maybe? 20, 25 years?
Sure.
Since he was doing that Negative Burn stuff. Yeah. Again, an anthology book, right? Like, that's what got me into it. Yeah, he's fantastic. I love it. I had a question about the new book you have, Shadow Roads.
Yes.
You guys put out the first issue for Free Comic Book Day. And then it was released as the same issue, a couple weeks ago is when the first issue came out.
Yes. For pay. Yeah. You could buy it if you wanted.
Yeah, you could buy it. I'm curious to know what the reasoning behind that was. Cause I thought that was a really interesting marketing move. I've been looking at like how some of the different publishers are strategizing on how to do different things. Like, you know, Kirkman had this new book that came out last week that was announced like the day before it came out.
Right.
And I thought that was really an interesting way to do it, because now with the internet, it's like, you know, you know about books like 6 months ahead of time, and it doesn't have that same feeling as like when I was growing up reading books in the late 80s, early 90s, and I would just go to like this little Korean deli. Okay. I didn't even have a comic store. There was this little Korean deli. I would go in there and he had a bunch of comics. And not just spinner racks, like he had them on the wall. And it was like a nice surprise to go and see what was there. What was the reasoning behind you guys doing this thing on Free Comic Book Day, and why do the full issue?
Well, you know, Shadow Roads is sort of a follow-up to The Sixth Gun.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a sequel comic, but it takes place in the same world. And The Sixth Gun was a book that years ago, you know, 6-7 years ago, we released the first issue on Free Comic Book Day. And we released the entire first issue. Part of the reason for releasing the entire first issue is Brian Hurt, my collaborator, and I felt so strongly about the material. We felt that if people read the story, they would come back and continue reading the book. You know, and we say that to this day. You know, when we go to conventions and we sell a trade of the volume one, in our minds, we just sold volumes 2 through 8, because I don't know very many people who read volume one and not pick up the rest of the series. You know, I'm not trying, you know, that's a book that we're not going to be falsely humble about. We are proud of that book, and we think every issue is strong. We think every trade is stronger than the last one. And that's coming from me, a guy who's overly critical of his own work. The Sixth Gun is a strong book. And we felt that way going from the very beginning with The Sixth Gun. So that's why we did that as a Free Comic Book Day. We thought it would be a great way to get many more eyes on the book than we would necessarily get if we just put it out, you know, on the shelves and had people, you know, pre-order it with their retailer and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we put it out that way, and then you know, a month or two later, we also released a for sale number one for the people who don't want to stand in line on Free Comic Book Day. The people who aren't willing to take, you know, to stand in line, or the people who just missed it on Free Comic Day. So when we started to do Shadow Roads, we thought, well, let's do the exact same thing that we did with Six Gun. We'll release it, the entire issue. You can read in the entire first issue. You can see exactly what you're going to get. And if you like it, you can, you know, make sure you get the, you know, the rest of the series. And again, we did that because we felt strongly in the book. We thought people would follow it. If they read the first issue, they'd come back for more. And it's really just taking a chance on the material, really. It's saying, yes, we might lose sales in, you know, on number one for people. You know, some people get it the Free Comic Book Day. Why would they buy a new number, you know, buy number one? And that's fine. We want them to stick around for the long haul. if they will. You know, a six gun, we wanted it. We knew in our minds it was going to be at least a, you know, at least 30 something issues. It ended up running 50 issues, but we knew it was, we wanted it to, you know, we wanted the book to be out for the long haul. And that's why we took a chance with that first issue. I still like that. I still like the idea of releasing first issues for free, on, you know, the entire first issue, that's not a reprint and not, you know, not a, you know, a truncated story. I love the idea, you know. Is it, who knows if it's the best way? going back to not wanting to be the guy who has to figure out how to sell comics, you know, who knows if it's the best, you know, the best way of doing things, but I like it personally. And I think it gives readers something, you know, something fun to, you know, they can get the entire first issue.
Yeah. I think it's definitely interesting, right? I think in particular for the creator to get that workout and then for the reader, cause you can just pick it up, right?
Right.
I think so often a lot of the comic industry is so centered around getting a book to a comic shop and not necessarily to a reader, right?
Right.
Like all the variant incentives and this and that and the other, whatever the hell they do. But I like that better, right? Because ultimately, like, yeah, the shop may be the one ordering the book. I don't know. Like, if you didn't have a following, you know, if people didn't want to read the book, then the shop wouldn't even carry it to begin with.
Well, it's tough. It's tough for readers and it's tough for retailers. I think there are so many books coming out right now. You know, good news, bad news. There's a ton of books coming out, a book mm-hmm. for every kind of taste and interest. That's the good news. Bad news is there's a ton of books coming out and it's very, it's very difficult, I think, for the reader to one, find these books, and two, to figure out which ones are going to be worth their time. Mm-hmm. And that same difficulty comes to the retailer. It's tough for a retailer to judge, you know, what's going to be a success. You know, if they have a perfect thumb on the pulse of their clientele, they might be able to say, I know that, you know, 30 readers are going to buy this book. Hands down, I guarantee they're going to, you know, they're going to buy it. And other retailers can say, you know I can hand sell 100 copies of this book because I believe in it and I like it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I think it's tough, you know, not every retailer, you know, has that mindset. Not every retailer works the same way. You know, they're, you know, I get reports. I know what retailers sell more of my books than others. I absolutely can tell you which retailers are in my top 20 retailers of my titles.
Right.
And some of them, you know, I call them and say, how come you guys sold, you know, you sold out of this issue or you sold out of this trade paperback so much faster than, you know, this retailer did or another retailer? And the answer is almost always, we believed in the book, we thought our clients would like it, and we talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's the, you know, that's really the only way. And that's not always, you know, judge, you know, the retailer has to be able to look at this giant catalog of books and figure out which books in there they feel like they can talk about, they can sell to their readers, you know, and they can get behind. And you know, so, you know, you are selling to the reader, absolutely, but, and you're absolutely trying to sell to the retailer as well because, they're the first line. They're the people yeah. who buy the books and put them on the shelf. They have to have faith that they can move those books because nobody wants the book sitting on the shelf. I don't want my book sitting on a shelf not being sold. I'd much rather, you know, it's another weird situation. I don't want my book sitting on a shelf, but I don't want them selling out too fast either. You know, I want, if they sell out instantly, that means not enough copies were ordered.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, I think about that every time somebody announces like, oh, this book's going to second printing, third printing, and the book's not even out yet. Like that tells me you just didn't print enough.
Yeah, you didn't print enough, but you can only print what, you know, gets ordered too. You can't sure. print that much more over what's getting ordered. Otherwise, you know, those books are getting pulped, you know, at some point.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've gotten comp boxes full of books from publishers, and this hasn't happened in a long while, but years ago, I remember that comp boxes used to come and they were padded with shredded other comics. And I lived in mortal terror of opening a comp box and finding that the shredded book was one of mine, you know. So, I mean, yeah, it's such a weird balancing act.
That's amazing. Yeah, I was, I read a Wired article yesterday. It's the, does comics culture have an inferiority complex?
And oh, I saw that. Yeah.
So in the article, he mentions that for this month, there are 1,194 new comics being put out and 391 graphic novels in collections. I mean, that's tough for anybody. Like, I spend a lot of money on comics every month, and I'm nowhere near getting that many comics. So, yeah. I don't know, like, what they're including, right? Like, there must be some tiny indie publishers in this list.
I'm sure there are. I mean, like I said, if you look at a previews catalog, it's 300 pages at least, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
yep.
a massive novel.
Yep.
So.
It's gigantic.
Yeah, and think about it. You know, there are retailers. I have a friend who just opened his own comic shop, and I have another friend who owns a comic shop, and they're close friends. You know, I consider all retailers my friend. So yeah. If you're listening, retailers, you are all my friends. But I do have a couple of close friends who are comic shop owners, and they both say they read every page of that previews catalog. And I think to myself, what a nightmare.
No kidding.
That sounds – get a couple of cups of coffee, sit down, and enjoy reading the previews catalog. I flip through every page, but I don't read every entry. That's just too much.
That is.
But if I owned a comic shop, I guess I would have that becomes, that's part of the job. And the added stress of trying to figure out when you read these entries, can I sell that,
Well, and I think in particular, good shops that have a strong clientele, right? Because you can always tell, like, a shop that is really in it because, I mean, yeah, obviously they want to make money and they want to stay open. But you can always kind of tell the shops that really love comics and have a staff that loves comics and a shop that maybe just wants to sell, Marvel books, for example, and everything else is secondary, right?
Well, look, I think a comic shop is going to be a reflection of the owner. And some owners, that's what they like. Mm-hmm. They like Marvel books. And that's what they're going to focus on. And that's great. It makes it difficult sometimes. That's where it falls to the reader and becomes difficult for the reader that they have to be the judge. So if their only comic shop within, 100 miles is a big two only shop, but they want to try some different things, it becomes a little more difficult. They have to look at that previews catalog. Mm-hmm. They have to go online and see what people are doing or what people are talking about. And then they have to order it. And it's tough for me to imagine any shop owner who would, if someone comes in and says, hey, I would like to order a copy of this indie book. It's very difficult for me to imagine a shop owner who's going to say, nope, because that's in theory a guaranteed sell,
Yeah. Yeah. So you've been in comics for a long time now. Do you feel, I know earlier you mentioned about a fear you have of artists not having enough work. Do you ever feel like, even after all this time in the industry, that you could kind of take a step back and maybe relax a little bit when you're trying to do a new book or push a new book, market a new book?
No. Not only do I fear that one day all my work will dry up, or fear that if I stop hustling and stop contacting editors and stop looking for new work or stop pitching new projects. Not only do I fear that one day that will all end, I know that one day that will all end. There is no doubt in my mind. You can be on top of the world as a creator. You could be working on more titles than anyone else. You can be exclusive to somehow you could be exclusive to both Marvel and DC. Who knows? but you could be, exactly where you want to be and it will dry up. Mm-hmm. I know it will. So if I take my eye off the prize, that's a risk and you have to be very careful about that. I try to take more time with my books. It's not, there have been times where I was working on so many books that, you can't even take a breath and there were times where I was writing a lot of books. I was ghost writing books for other creators. I was co-writing books with other creators, all to make sure someone was, to make sure deadlines were being met. And it's tough to really take the time you want with your books. I guess the theme of our talk today is balancing act. Mm-hmm. Now I'm in a stage where I'm balancing, taking the time I need to on these titles, but also keeping the eye on what's next and what's going to come out next and what am I going to do next. Because if ever I stop, you know, people will forget about you.
Yeah.
An editor who's giving you title after title after title will forget about you because there are dozens of other creators out there who are also trying to sell title after title after title. And that's not to be grim. I don't want to sound grim for any aspiring creators out there. I'm just saying you can work in comics and you can work for a long, long time in comics, but you got to take it seriously and you got to realize it's a business and you got to keep hustling.
Well, especially as a freelancer, right? You've got to hustle.
Yeah, no, you know, you're always, you know, that's the thing you take on when you become a freelancer is you have to hustle. And it's not just looking for work with other, with publishers and editors. It's also, you have to market your own work because, you know, you will find that you will become the number one marketer for most of your stuff, especially when you're doing creator-owned stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that I'd love to be able to spend more time on that just has to take a back seat to some degree. You know, as much as I feel like I do, I still have to take a back seat to you know, on that because the creation of the books is taking precedence right now.
Absolutely. All right, I only have one more question for you, and then I want you to – tell me about Bone Parish a little bit. My
sure.
question to you is, why is Emma Frost the greatest mutant of all time? And do you ever have plans or hopes of writing an Emma Frost series?
Well, it sounds like a loaded question, but but Emma Frost is great because she just doesn't give a damn.
Exactly.
How's that?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I think that's what makes her awesome. You know, I know there is a huge debate out there of villain versus superhero. And I absolutely lean more towards villain than superhero. And that's not because I dislike Emma Frost or anything like that. I kind of feel like publishers too often turn their greatest villains into heroes.
Yep.
You know, they see a popularity among the villain. So let's turn him into a hero. And fans want that. They think, but I've always liked Emma. I think I'll firmly say she's an anti-hero. And I think she's a great anti-hero. Not only does she have cool power sets and she has a cool background and she has a great attitude, but really it's all about swagger and attitude, mm-hmm. right? That's what makes Emma Frost Emma Frost.
Absolutely.
As for writing an Emma Frost series, no. As much as I love the character, I think there are probably better creators out there for her. And I don't even know who I'd have in mind right now.
Yeah.
But I would love to see, a woman write an Emma Frost series. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some creators out there who could really just sell that. If not that, I would say, if not a woman writing it, then I would still say it's not for me. I think Dennis Hopeless is probably a better choice to write an Emma Frost series. I think he has a great voice for her, and I would read the hell out of an Emma Frost book he wrote.
Yeah.
But as much as I love the character, I don't think I would take it. You know, I don't think I'd write that book. Yeah. I definitely wouldn't go out and pitch an Emma Frost solo book. Now, a team book with Emma Frost on it—that's a different story. Yes, I'd be all over that. But a solo Emma Frost story, I think you want somebody that has a little bit of a different voice than I have. And that's just about being self-aware as a creator. If you'd asked me 2 years ago, yep, I'd write that book because I would write any book, but I'd find a reason to like any character. But I think there are others who probably have a better voice for that character than me.
I had to throw that in there because obviously she's in your current run. You're dealing a lot with Magneto and Emma showed up. So, I love whenever Emma shows up, I just love it. Emma and, Blink. I love Blink and I love Magic. Those are my three favorite.
Yeah. Things. You know, Magic is a character I have, I've tried so hard to write a Magic series. Now that's a character that absolutely I would write. I have tons of ideas for a Magic series and, that I would, you know, and that's a character I would love to put in a series, you know, in a book. Imagine Magic as the John Constantine of the Marvel Universe.
Yes.
Think about how awesome that is.
Yeah.
and then tell Marvel, hey, Cullen Bunn should be writing that series, because I have, I have pitched that so many times over the past few years. but yeah, that's, you know, I agree, you know, she's a great character. Fandom for Emma is interesting only because, you know, when I took over X-Men Blue, Emma Frost had firmly been positioned as a villain in the Marvel Universe. And I am one of those guys that I want to honor what other creators have done, whether or not I agree with it or other, you know, other readers agree with it. You know, I'm going to, you know, follow that through. That's what continuity is. And you kind of have to stick with it. And I didn't want to just retcon that or forget about it. So when I started writing Emma, she's a villain in my series, and man, people hate Emma. You know, there's so many people who don't like Emma Frost as a villain. So you know, I always, when I first started, you know, I first put Emma in the book, I always had the intent that we'd move her back into this anti-hero space. And I think, you know, I've done that to enough of a degree that now some other writer can come in and do something, you know, even more exciting.
I'll take that. I'll take Emma whatever way I can. You know what I mean? I'm good with that.
Sure.
All right. So Bone Parish, that is coming out next week?
Next week is
Holy
shocking.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. So tell me about Bone Parish. By the way, greatest cover of the year, I think.
It's a cool cover, right?
Yeah. It's fantastic.
It's pretty awesome. Yeah. Bone Parish is a book I'm real excited about. I'm real proud of. It's coming out from Boom. And Bone Parish is a supernatural crime story. It's the story of this family, the Winters family, who is trying to make a name for themselves in the drug trade in New Orleans. And they are starting to gain some traction. They're starting to gain some infamy, and their product is starting to become very popular. But their product is what sets them apart. What this family is selling, the drug, is called the ash, and the ash is created from the bones and decayed bodies of the dead. Mm-hmm. And when you use this drug, you experience vivid memories of that dead, of that person. So if you want to feel what it's like to be a rock legend, you can take this drug that is composed of the ashes of this rock legend. And for a short while, you feel like you're on stage. You feel like you're singing. You feel like you're adored by millions. And you can, you know, you can take the, you know, you can take the bones and take this drug that has been made of any number of different kinds of people and experience what it's like to walk in their shoes. But there are complications when you have a very successful drug trade, and those complications come from internally. The family itself is, you know, a family in the best of times, a family can be a trying, group of people. You know, you can have differences of opinion, and you can have struggles within your family. Now, elevate the fact that you're trying to make it in a very dangerous business. But also that, you know, there are other, organizations who have taken note of this family and want to be involved in this family's business. Whether that is a hostile takeover or not remains to be seen. And there are complications in the drug itself. You know, we're starting, you know, when it's kind of proliferating and you see people, that are abusing this drug, and abusing a drug of this nature, has some pretty, pretty horrible side effects. So yeah, it's a book I'm really excited about. I can't wait for people to read the first issue. I think people are really going to dig. I think people are going to like this family of characters. I think the setting's awesome. I'm really excited about it. And it's a different kind of horror story. And it's a horror story. It's a crime story. It's a family story. There's lots of different elements to it.
I have a question, and I hope this does not influence in any way what you're doing, but I have this weird fascination with stories that deal with voodoo magic. Since this book is set in New Orleans, is there any of that kind of thing in here?
There are definite voodoo undertones in the series and voodoo elements. It's not what I would say, you know, it's not Serpent in the Rainbow But there are voodoo elements in, you know, mixed into the mythology of this world for sure.
Fantastic. I love it. I can't wait. This book took me by surprise. I know it was announced like a couple months ago and somehow I missed the announcement. And Ronnie and I were actually talking about something. He's like, hey, check out this book that Cullen's doing. And I looked at it and I started doing a little bit of research and I found the cover. And I was like, dude, you've got to look at this cover. And we were just sold immediately.
Yeah, well, I hope others are also sold on the cover as well. You know, it was originally greenlit as a 5-issue series, and Boom has come back, and we're now they've greenlit at least through issue 12. So they're really behind the book. They're really excited about it, and I think, like I said, I think readers are really going to like the book.
Well, I'm sure that says a lot about the initial reception, right? I'm assuming pre-orders were pretty good, that they would want to expand it to a fuller story. And I think especially
with
the writer.
Man, I hope so. I don't know where the pre-orders stand yet, but I hope so.
I think especially with a writer like yourself, and this is probably true with, I would say, most writers, really. I don't think 4 or 5 issues is enough for a lot of stories that authors want to tell, in particular when they seem really passionate about it. You know what I'm saying? Like you really want to have a much longer story going on. And I know it's tough because a lot of times publishers kind of want you to write for a trade. But really when you let the story breathe a little bit, I think it excels quite a bit more.
Yeah. You know, it's just tough. You know, again, the publisher has to make sure the book's going to sell and can support it. You know, there's the trouble, you know. People often ask me, you know, is this a limited series when a book's announced? Is this a limited series or an ongoing? And the answer is it's a limited series unless people buy it. You know, if the book doesn't sell, you're going to get the first trade out of it. And that may be it, you know, but every book is a limited series unless people support it.
Fair enough. I want to thank you for your time. I didn't mean to take up this much of your time. So thank you for being so kind with it. Why don't you let everyone know the million things that you do and where they can find you?
Well, you know, right now I have a new book coming out, Bone Parish. Bone Parish is just starting up from Boom. And then I also, you know, from Marvel, I have Deadpool Assassin, which is currently running, and X-Men Blue, which is wrapping up very soon. I'm also working on, a number of books from Dark Horse that haven't been announced yet, and some new Aftershock books that haven't been announced. You know, right now, Brothers Dracul and Dark Ark are currently running from Aftershock. But you can always keep up with what I'm doing. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at Cullen Bunn, super easy to find. You can find my website, which is www.cullenbunn.com. Those are probably the best places to really keep up with what I'm doing.
And I've been following your Tumblr the last few days. Your Tumblr is amazing.
Yeah, I forget about the Tumblr for a while, and then I go back and check it, and I've got questions. You know, I answer a lot of questions on Tumblr, but sometimes it takes me a few days.
Sure. All right, awesome. Thanks for hanging out. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. You know, thank you so much.
Now I want to thank Cullen once again for joining me on the podcast. I really enjoyed our conversation. I hope you did as well. I know some of you wanted me to ask certain questions. The interview didn't lend itself to that, guys. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I definitely enjoyed the way that the interview went. And you know, usually I try to keep my interviews a little bit different than the standard generic, what are you working on? What is this character doing kind of thing? So of course, you can find Cullen on Twitter at Cullen Bunn. I'm on Twitter at Geekvine. You can email the show, nerdallegiant@gmail.com. I will be back tomorrow with special guest Aaron Bell from the Absolute DC podcast, and you may think to yourself, great, you guys are going to talk about DC, and you're wrong. We are going to talk about our newfound love for Marvel Comics. It's going to be a fantastic episode. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you then.